Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored once again by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. The Business Creators Radio Show is from the field, and we take you where you go to have those aha moments and mastermind meetings that can transform your trajectory and bring you closer to your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. Dang, that's pretty good. Somebody should be recording this. Thank goodness they are. And you can subscribe to Business Creators Radio Show on pretty much any network. We're on just about all of them at this point. So at any rate, you may occasionally hear a little bit of ambient noise in the background. We don't have a $25,000 Hollywood quality soundproof stereo, nor do we want one. Sometimes I do these episodes from public places. Today, we're doing it from the living room, my apartment here in Las Vegas, the hottest city in America. And I am accompanied on this end by our two feline office assistants, Princess Alessandra and Princess Stella. And dialing in is somebody I've been looking to connect with for a while. His name is David Jaffe. Let me tell you about him. He was Amazon's first global vice president of customer service and is the founder and president of Driva Solutions, which is a consultancy dedicated to creating highly effective customer service or customer contact strategies and operations. He has more than 35 years experience advising and directing major operations in more than 160 leading companies. And part of the reason he's here today is he's the co-author, along with Bill Price, of a book called The Frictionless Organization: Deliver Great Customer Experiences with Less Effort. Also author of the bestseller, The Best Service is No Service, Your Customer Rules. We are going to have ourselves a very interesting conversation. Let's get right to it. David Jaffe, come on in. The weather's fine.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Adam. And I'm talking to you from Melbourne, Australia. So this may be, I don't know how often you get Australians onto your broadcast, but it's great to be here. We're at the other end of the day. Of course, it's actually, I'm actually a day ahead of you, I think. It's already our Thursday to your Wednesday or whatever it is. So
I lose track all the time myself, and you'd be surprised how many Australians we've had. We've had a lot, and some of them even live in Australia.
Oh, cool.
So
there you go.
So before we dive in, I just read off part of your bio. It's so impressive that I'm not sure I'm worthy to be here. And this is my show. I'm not sure I'm worthy to be in your presence. So what we want you to do is tell us a bit about your journey in your own words and what's brought you to where you are here today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
Right. Well, Bill and I have worked together now for nearly 20 years. So some of what you described in that resume is actually Bill's profile. Bill was the first ever VP of customer service for Amazon.
Okay.
And Bill and I have actually written books together now, Bill Price, for this is our third book together. So those three books you mentioned are all ones we've written together.
Right.
And we now have both moved into consultancy and have been consultants and run our own consulting businesses for nearly 20 years.
Yours is Lionbridge, Australia.
That's right. Correct.
So now it's really going to stand out. This will probably be the first time on the Business Creators Radio Show I've ever actually read off the incorrect bio. But you know what? Part of the beauty of podcasting is it's meta-marketing, and you embrace the mistakes and have fun with them. So let's get back to talking about you,
Adam, that you got to hear about Bill, because I would have introduced Bill anyway, because I think it's always important that we talk about, you know, how we came together and why we've been writing these books. So as you mentioned, our first book together was called The Best Service is No Service. And that was coming from, I think, Bill's passion originally when he joined Amazon about, you know, how he even got the job. So believe it or not, he had an interview directly with Jeff Bezos. We're talking over 20 years ago now. And Bezos asked him, what's your philosophy about customer service? Because he was, interviewing for this position of global VP of customer care. And Bill said, well, I think customer care should be trying to put itself out of business. And this got Bezos's attention. What do you mean? And Bill said, well, customer service doesn't cause the problems that customers call about. We're just there to fix them. And therefore, what we need to do is work with the rest of the business to try and understand, what's gone on, what's gone wrong, and how we can get rid of these things once and for all. And so I think that's why he got the job. And he spent 3 to 4 years, as I say, some years ago, working on putting in place the sort of building blocks of Amazon's customer care operations and how they thought about these problems and how they tried to tackle them. And then that led in, once he left Amazon and created his own consulting firm, and we created this alliance of 10 firms around the world, including mine in Australia and his in America, we started working together on these problems across the board. And then in about 2005-06, we suddenly had this idea of writing a book together. We thought we should write some of this down because we couldn't understand why so many businesses weren't thinking this way. Why we're so busy dealing with the problems that we don't ask, why are they there? We're so busy trying to find the next person to answer the calls or the emails or deal with the chats that we're not saying, hang on, what's really going on here? Why are these customers don't want to call us? I think the second sentence in our first book was, no one wakes up in the morning wanting to ring their utility, right? We've got better things to do. And so that was the philosophy of the best service is no service. And people seem to like that idea. I mean, some people misunderstood it. Sometimes we got abuse online for, what do you mean the best service is no service? I want someone, to come to my table when I've got a problem or in a restaurant. Or we say, no, hang on a minute. Wouldn't you prefer that the food is what you expected, it's hot, it's tasty, and you don't need to call somebody over because there's a problem? So even in that sort of restaurant setting, the idea still applies.
Oh, yeah, like I don't want to have to go back and forth 5 times on the food. And I've had some issues with the place where I rent right now, and the management company saying that I keep stopping by their office and asking the same question over and over again. And I said, I said, number one, if I wasn't getting different answers every time, I'd stop asking. And number two, if I was getting the service that I'm paying for, then you wouldn't see me at all. In fact, I'd prefer not to see you.
Exactly. And that's where it gets really interesting, Adam, because sometimes people challenge Bill and I and say, well, hang on a minute, we get such great net promoter scores or customer sat ratings when we fix a problem. In fact, they're our highest rating customers. And we call that recovery theory. The idea that if you have a problem and you fix it well, customers love you. Well, that's true.
It is.
But of course, the sort of logical extension of that is, so do you make more problems so that you can make customers happier? I mean, it's kind of a nonsense when you think about it that way, to say, okay, so we make more problems because customers are happy. And it's a kind of weird measurement phenomena that develops, that, of course, immediately after having something fixed up well, we are very grateful and we do rate companies well for doing that. But the funny thing is very few organizations survey their customers who never have to deal with it or ask their customers, okay, so we dealt with that well, you like us, but would you have preferred it not to happen? No one ever asked the question, right? And so there's actually quite a body of research that shows that in organizations where problems don't occur, customers are more loyal, are prepared to spend more, and actually do rate them well, not as highly as, after immediately have that sort of sugar high of, oh, you just fixed my problem. But often are the most profitable and the most loyal customers. So we still think the philosophy holds, even though at times people object to it.
Oh, I get it perfectly. It's funny. It's funny looking at it from a service provider's perspective that if you are having to spend time on customer service, you're already irritated. If you have empathy and you have integrity, you're already irritated that you screwed up. And now, when you could be fixing it, you have to spend more time addressing it.
Correct.
It's like Now I have a way of that I recommend people deal with that, which is, and I'll paraphrase it. There's actually a bit more floweriness to it, but the idea is you say that, look, I think we can stipulate at this point that if you want to keep me on the line and keep going through emails, going looking for an aha gotcha moment, you're eventually going to find one. And the bottom line is this is where you feel you are. That is where you feel you should be. And between the two is the gap. So what if we focus right now on closing that gap, getting you satisfied, and then afterwards we can have all the postmortem you need?
Yeah. But you're right. We're not advocating, you're absolutely right, Adam. We're not advocating in any of our books that on the call, the person handling the problem or on the email is there to investigate the root cause and fix the root cause. Right. That's not what we employ frontline service people to do.
Yes. Right?
They're there to fix this instance and to get that customer back on the happy path, if you like, whatever that looks like. And obviously there's a degree of empowerment we need to give them, and we don't want to put too many barriers in their way, which we also talk about particularly our new book. So let me then roll forward and say, well, how did we get from Best Services, No Service as a book, which, you know, again, we're very happy that people a lot of organizations did kind of get it and adopt that philosophy. Yeah. And of course, people like Elon Musk talk about it, but in a different way. You know, his idea, he actually uses that phrase, but of course, he means no car service. You know, I shouldn't need to service the car,
right?
Because
in a way, that's not that far off. Because think about it: do you buy a car because you want to take it into service? Do you buy a car because you want to drive it? Yeah.
And every service is an annoyance, and it means I haven't got a vehicle for 2 or 3 hours or whatever it is. So we actually would prefer even that it still holds true. So rolling the clock forward, you know, why do we sit down and write another book? Are we, you know, gluttons for punishment? Few ideas behind the frictionless organization. One was the philosophy that we talk about. You know, there's this whole thinking about why the interactions are even there still holds good. But we felt like the world had become more complex for the customer and for many organizations, that we're now dealing not just with phone calls and emails, but now we're dealing with web chat and we're dealing with social media interactions. Yep. And so customers can deal with organizations across many, we call them channels, you know, many different ways of touching a business and the customer, which was making it harder for organizations to get their head around all the problems because they're popping up all over the place. Secondly, we deliberately changed the title of the book. If there was a problem with our Best Services, No Service title, it was that some organizations thought, oh, this is a problem for the service guys. You know, the book's called The Best Services, No Service, therefore it's services problem. And they still didn't get this idea that actually this is a whole of business problem. That if we're going to fix these problems, that it's probably not customer service that's going to fix them. Customer service is going to show us where the problems are. And then it's going to be billing, or it's going to be product design, or it's going to be the web design guys who are going to fix things that customers are actually struggling with. Right. And so we think the frictionless organization is almost like an aspirational strategy for business to say, shouldn't you be trying to make yourselves frictionless? Because if you do, there's so many benefits, right? Customers are happier. It costs less, right? We're not having to employ tens, 15s, hundreds of people to deal with problems. We're not having to write stuff off or repair stuff or send out a repair crew or deal with returns of things that aren't working or deal with, have to cancel orders because they didn't get there in time. All those things cost money, right? And if we can create a lower cost operation, then we can reinvest in other things for the customer. It could be product discounts, could be, spending time on customers in value add ways, you know, showing them other products and services, all sorts of things. I think the media sometimes, not yourself, obviously, but, you know, sometimes newspapers and television stations portray the idea that any businesses that is cutting costs is hurting service. That, you know, we would somehow hold back staff and don't have enough people to do the job. And obviously in these particular times, that's often the case, but that cost cutting must be at the expense of the customer, if you like. And what we're saying here is if we tackle the right problems, that we can cut costs and make life better for the customer. right? Because we're getting rid of the annoyances. We're getting rid of the things that don't work well. We're delivering stuff on time. We're making the customer's life easier. And it actually takes work out of a business if we do it the right way. Does that make sense?
Makes dollars and sense. I mean, frictionless is the way to go. It goes back to what I said. Already there's a problem, and now we have to spend time nurturing the problem. I mean, I've been in situations where it seemed like they just wanted to tell stories and be upset about the fact that I was asking for the service I felt I was paying for. So there were times I would just, okay, you want to waste time? I'll really waste some time. And I would just invent questions for them to answer just to take up more of their time, just to demonstrate that they were more interesting in arguing over it than solving the problem. I was waiting for the part where they say, you know, the time that we're having this conversation right now is actually time taken away from us being able to resolve this. I was waiting for that phrase, and I never heard it.
Exactly. I mean, as you're hinting out there, Adam, and we say resolution is all important in these interactions, right? That why do we ring up as customers, or why do we send an email? We want a problem solved. But you know, above everything else, you know, we're prepared to wait a little bit of time and invest a bit of time if we get a problem solved, right? Yeah. So we totally agree with that. And we talk in the book about, you know, sort of two mechanisms that help deal with that, or two strategies. One is to try and simplify those interactions that we do have to have. So make them as simple as we can and as streamlined as we can.
Right.
And as you hinted again, we get the double win there, because, you know, less time spent on something for the customer, or less effort, is also less time spent on it by the business, right? But sometimes businesses don't always recognize the time customers are investing, because they might measure part of it. So you might measure, you know, the handling time that an operator spends, you know, dealing with you, the customer, but we haven't measured all the time the customer's invested up to that point to navigate the website, to find the contact details, to put together their email, or navigate a complicated, you know, voice response system and all that stuff. So we actually need to think about the totality of the customer's effort, as well as the workload that it creates within the business. And that can help us think about, you know, where opportunities are as well. So we say the first thing we need to do across all of this, if you like, the first chapter of the book, is to understand what's going on today. Because if we're right that the definition of friction should be any interaction that a customer has with a business that they really don't want to have and that the business doesn't want to have, then actually we've already got a whole load of data on that in most businesses. We should already understand why customers are having to send emails, why customers are ringing up, why customers are having to chat with us on the website because they don't understand things, all those things. But it's hard now. In theory, it's harder because there's more, as I said earlier, there's more ways we can interact as customers. But in some ways, there's now some fantastic tools and technology capabilities that didn't exist 10, 15 years ago to actually make sense of all that. So rather than have, you know, the people you deal with in the customer care operations, or in the branch or the frontline area that you're face to facing, have to log, you know, what was this about and why did the customer have to do this? There's now great analytical tools that you can rent and buy and source that help you classify all that stuff. So we can put the analytics engines and things like that to work to start to give us a continuous picture of what's going on out there. What are these points of friction? What are customers having to deal with? How much are they really costing? Right? How often are customers having to do this, do repeat their activity, as you described? You know, how often does Adam have to go in four times to get one thing done? Right?
Yeah.
Believe it or not, many organizations struggle to track that. They don't know. And we're saying, well, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to understand it, because then the priorities become much clearer. And therefore, chapter two of the book talks about, well, how do you prioritize? And how do you assign or make the right people accountable? Because again, it's not the customer, not the people fielding the inquiries or fielding the problems who are necessarily the cause. Very unlikely. Most of the time, it's some other area of the business, and we've got to bring them to the table. And that typically means quite a lot of sponsorship or support from executives and organizations. So in a startup business, and I know you have a lot of listeners who are in those kinds of businesses, hopefully it's a bit easier to get your hands around the problem, because you know we're a slightly smaller organization and we're more connected to the things going on with customers. We might, you know, a startup business might be both the head of billing and the head of customer service all in one, right? And so they hopefully have that connectedness. But the more you grow, the more we start to lose that connection, because now you have a dedicated customer service team and they're separate, and maybe they're in a new different building now, or you know, maybe we've gone offshore to go and, you know, try and find some cheap labor to try and do some of these things, and we're even less connected to it. And that's, I think that's one of the reasons why over the last 20 or 30 years, as customers, we're not that much happier. Because a lot of businesses chose those kind of shortcuts and said, oh, I can get it done cheaply in Manila. I can get it done, you know, there's some guys in India to help me do this, and they'll you know, they'll cost a lot less. And the business took the dollars, but didn't look at what was that doing to the customer through the experience, and how often they not get that resolution, and how often is it taking them longer, and they're having to explain more, and all those things. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, it reminds me of something. This is similar to the topic. There are times when I need to go to the local branch of my bank to deposit handwritten checks.
Wow. All okay. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So here, so I get there and there'll be a line almost all the way out the door.
Right.
And meanwhile, there are only two teller stations open, one of which, for some reason, you have five people trying to help one person, and the other is just obviously being monopolized by a chatty Cathy customer. So what happens? You have all these people standing in line, and then you have other people who work for the bank branch coming down the line asking, what are you here to do today? What are you here to do today? And the usual answers are, I'm here to, or as follows, one of which is, well, I'm here to withdraw money today. And they'll say, yeah, did you know that you can make that withdrawal from the ATM right here? And they'll say, your ATM only serves 20 and 50s. I need $100 bills. I need $2 bills. I need coins. Therefore, I need the teller. Okay. So then they ask the next person, and the next person says, well, I'm here to make this deposit. And then they say, did you know that you can make your deposit using the ATM right there? And they'll say, and then the customer will say, if I wanted to use the ATM to make the deposit, I could have used that one. I could have used the three in your lobby. I could have used the one in your drive-thru. I could have used the one outside my grocery store. I'm here because I want to use a teller to make my deposits. And then another round of employees coming down. Now they're trying to sell mortgages and financial investments to people who just want to make deposits and withdrawals. Now, there's a crazy solution to this. It's unbelievably simple. You got a line of people out the door who just need to make simple, basic withdrawals and deposits. So, A, you dedicate an express window, express withdrawals and deposits only. That means only come to this window if you're withdrawing or depositing. And the word express means have your stuff together and chatty Cathy, go somewhere else. Yeah. We're here to process these people through. And here's the other one. Once you've determined that just because you mentioned that your bank happens to offer mortgages, it's not going to cause the people in line to just spontaneously break down and decide to buy the house.
Yeah.
You got people going around asking questions over and over again. What are you here for? What are you here for? Well, now that you know, having asked real-time customers in your branch today what they're here for, and they keep saying withdrawals, deposits, then get your ass behind the counter, open some more windows, and start doing deposits and withdrawals. That's what they're here for today. You're more likely to get your mortgages and your investments sold if they feel they have a positive experience today just getting Aunt Molly's $75 check in the bank.
Yeah, I hear your frustration, Adam, and I can see all the, you know, all the I can sense the what the banks have tried to do behind that. I'm not saying I support it. So clearly, you know, virtually every organization has this idea of they want their customers to do more on digital these days, and we know
upselling,
Let's put the upselling to one side for a second. Okay. Let's just talk about the transactional stuff. And they want us all to go online and do stuff. They want us all to use the technology they've provided. And you know, there's a clear benefit to some of that a lot of the time. And there's a benefit to us, the customer, a lot of the time, because it is convenient. And if we don't have to leave home to deposit the check or to transfer money, then we kind of win. The customers had a win out of that. But the issue for me is, okay, if you've got physical checks, then there's potentially no other way to do it. So of course they should continue to support that if that's a a legitimate mechanism that and a legitimate need. And of course, they should think about streamlining the process within a branch so that, you know, there is a fast transaction window and a slow transaction window, if you like, or ways to organize around that. Just like, you know, if you go to a well-organized, you know, sandwich bar, someone takes the orders and someone else makes the sandwiches, right?
Right.
You know, and that's an example of a sort of streamlined process that works well, because you don't want people, you know, going from the till, having to put a pair of gloves on, then getting the bread out. And, you know, it just adds time to every process. So you're asking for a reasonable thing by saying, how can we streamline and organize? But to do that, as you're also hinting at chapter one of our book, because you're saying we need to understand the nature of those transactions. And I'd even challenge and say, can we go one layer deeper and ask why the person who's not using the ATM for deposits isn't using it, right? We haven't got to the cause yet. And the cause might be because I want a handwritten, you know, receipt, or you know, I had a bad experience once because this happened, and I'm fearful that might happen again, that, you know, I put some money in and I didn't, you know, then I had to dispute the transaction because it never showed up, or there's some reason why that isn't working, right? Let me give an example of that. It's quite an old example now. There was a bank in the UK where people use those. Do you remember passbooks? You know, those sort of books where you used to act as a running sort of statement of your transactions and things.
Yep.
And this particular financial institution had lots of customers use those, and therefore they wouldn't go to the ATM, right? Because the ATM wouldn't print in their passbook and give the record of the transaction and all that. Until they suddenly realized, well, why can't, you know, we create an ATM that deals with passbooks? Why can't we print in their book? And voila, you know, they worked with their technology provider, created a machine that could print in the passbook, update the passbook as a teller would, and guess what? Customers started using it. And there was another great example related to that, where older customers weren't comfortable using ATMs because they would, you know, put their card in, and if they couldn't remember their PIN, if they had a senior moment, if you like, the machine would swallow the card. Right?
Yep, I remember
and
that.
And suddenly you haven't got a card, and suddenly you can't get access to your bank account. So it created this fear of the technology. But the usability fix was a simple one. They turned it from a swallowing machine to a swiping machine so that the customer kept the card whatever happened. And suddenly that fear went away. So all I'm using those stories to illustrate is that if we get deep enough into understanding what it is that's stopping our customers using certain types of technology, maybe we can find a solution. Right. I mean, I'm seeing now technology solutions for things that I didn't think were going to be possible via self-service. So we have institutions now in Australia who, rather than me have to go into doing certain types of security checking to get certain government services, I might have previously had to go into a physical outlet with my passport, my driver's license, a whole bunch of identity stuff. Right. And now some of these services are provided online with smart technology that can read my passport via a photo, can match it to my driver's license, can go access databases to check that this is all legitimate, can then match it to a photo I've taken on my phone of myself to check that I am that person, and do all these kind of things without even leaving home, right? So the technology is moving on so fast that we are going to have more self-service available to us that will be convenient. And I think part of the trick is organizations have to share this benefit with the customer. If they try and take all the benefits for themselves, like to get all the cost savings and things like that, and there's no sharing in any way or no legitimate benefit for the customer, then why will we want to adopt those things, right?
Yeah,
but right. If it is more convenient and it's reasonably easy to use, then we are potentially happy to do it. But if it's making work for us, the customer, then we will resent it and we won't want to adopt it. So what that person walking the line is trying to do, as you've already identified, is move customers to available types of self-service technology where possible.
Yeah.
But But is that when there's such a long line and that person could be serving customers and getting rid of the queue altogether, you know, is it the right trade-off? And I think you're right to ask the question.
You bring up something too. A lot of times when it comes to like depositing checks, that can be done through mobile apps. However, yeah. mobile apps for depositing checks have really become fairly good only within the past couple years. I remember I used to have a lot of problems with it, and they kept swearing the app works. No, it doesn't. I finally started to see some more success with it. But the thing is Aunt Polly is still going to write you a check.
Yeah.
It's still going to be in her 1920s handwriting. And the perception, whether it's accurate or not, I haven't even tested this, is the mobile app scanner to deposit the check ain't going to pick it up.
Yeah.
And then you have the perception that, oh yeah, I can go to the ATM. I can just type in the total number of my deposits, stick it in an envelope and all is well. But there are still enough stories of people getting their money frozen because, oh, somebody couldn't read the check.
Yeah.
Those are perceptions you got to work on, going back to what you said.
Yeah. And those glitches and those exceptions. Let me talk about another type of technology. And we talk about this in the book as well, which is, you know, and let me explain the sort of business perspective and then the customer perspective with it. And that's, you know, this idea of chatbots now. So when you go and chat on a website, what a lot of big organizations want to do is have some kind of automation deal with that request first. And sometimes they're, you know, the first thing they have to be is transparent and say, look, I am a chatbot. I am going to try and handle this first. So at least we're aware of that and we don't think we're really chatting with a person when we're not, right? Because I think we all resent that straight away. Saying, well, hang on, why did you deceive me and claim there was going to be someone on the other end of this and then there isn't? So, firstly, some transparency. Look, I'm a chatbot. I can deal with 30% of your inquiries. If I don't succeed, I will get you to someone quickly, right? We're probably all prepared to make that investment and give that a go. Sure. Now, the other thing I mentioned there deliberately was that, you know, I said 30% or maybe it's 20%, because typically the chatbots can't do everything. And typically we're now talking that they might only be able to do 20, 30, 40% of what you're requesting, right? And they are trying to use AI to make them smarter and smarter so that they increase. But that means that 70 to 80% of people are failing with that chatbot. So you're going to say, so I, as an institution, am prepared to put all my customers through this experience, and 70 to 80% of them are going to fail. That's a really interesting equation, isn't it? So why are companies doing that, right? Well, companies are doing that because the 20 or 30% that succeed, it's completely automated and therefore virtually free for the business, right? So the business case is outstanding. The return on that investment, if I look at the pure dollars and cents, is outstanding for the business. But the net customer return is not so good. And few organizations weigh that up and go, am I prepared to eliminate 20% of manned transactions, but deal with the fact that 80% of people will fail? Right? That's the real equation we've got to weigh up.
I don't like those. Those odds one bit. And I mean, one of the things I'd like to see chatbots used more for is the utility company, whether it's the electric company, the gas company, the internet company. So let's say, for example, I'm here and I'm kind of a nocturnal creature, so I may be working on a project really late. So I've got a project that's due tomorrow. It's 12:30 a.m. I know I got about 2 hours to wrap this up, and then things are going to be good. And all of a sudden, the internet goes out. You want to know what I want to know at 12:30 in the morning before the project is due? I want to know, how long is the internet going to be out? When's it going to be back on?
Yeah, absolutely.
But yet, I have to jump through 25 different hoops. It's not always as bad, but I will tell you one example of I called the internet service provider, and they said they wouldn't help me until I went through the entire process of trying to reboot my router. And I said, I've already done this. I know how. And they said, we are not allowed to help you until you do this. I said, the internet is out. You're not going to be able to access the router, but I'll play your game. And they said, we can't seem to reach your router because the internet is like, no shit, Sherlock, really? So I tried to tell you 10 minutes ago. I called looking for two things. I looked for two things. Confirmation, you know, the internet's out, and an ETA on when it's back on, so I can plan around it. That's all I need. So if you can make a chatbot that can solve those inquiries, think about the internet company. I bet you that might be 50% of their phone calls, and the next 30% might be, where do I go to pay my bill?
Exactly. So the interesting thing, we talk about that kind of scenario in the book. We talk about it in a chapter we call preempt, right? Yeah. Which is preemptive strategies. It's not for, you know, sometimes organizations are overdoing it these days and they're trying to sort of predict your next problem and things like that. But we're saying when something does go wrong, like internet outage, like electricity outage, like, you know, those things will go wrong. We all know things will go wrong. There'll be storms. There'll be, you know, someone cuts a cable. No one can help those things, right? But in those situations, organizations, once they know about it, they have the technologies now to reach out to customers really quickly through text messages, through emails, through, you know, and obviously sending you an email when the internet's down is not going to help you very much, right? But sending you a text message that keeps you informed is useful, right? As soon as they knew about the outage, if they could have said to you something, say, we know our service is down in your area. Our best guess at the moment is we hope to have the service back up and running by, you know, 4 a.m. Yep.
That answers the two questions, because remember, I had two questions. A, are you guys aware there's an outage? Yes.
Exactly.
B, what's your ETA? Knowing that it's an estimate. That's what the E stands for, estimate.
And they could even go further. They could even say, and we'll give you another update at 3 a.m. if the situation changes. So you feel in control. And the reason we wrote a chapter called Preempt is because, the technologies to do this are very mature. They're cheap to use. I mean, sending out a text broadcast to a million customers hardly costs you a thing. Right. Compared in the old days, you know, you couldn't have got on the phone and rung a million customers. You'd still be there next year. Right. But now you can do those things in seconds. So we're saying, so why aren't we? You know, why aren't we? And in the book, we use good and bad stories. So we illustrate some companies who are doing those things. Right. Just like when we have a bad when airlines, you know, have delays and things, you know, you've got to put the customer in control. Of being able to make decisions about what's going to happen in their life. If I know a flight's going to be now delayed by 3 hours, I want to know so I can rearrange some meetings or tell my wife I won't make it home to dinner or cancel my theater tickets or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And those preemptive strategies are now possible, right? And they're another type of a way of avoiding those kind of frictions. And we as you said, if you'd had that experience, Adam, where they sent you a text and they updated you, you'd have been grateful. You'd have felt, wow, this company cares about me.
Just to be able to go to a bot and say, I think my internet's down, and get a response that says, outages have been reported in the Las Vegas area. Estimated time to get it back on is 3 hours. Okay, that answers my two questions. You guys know it's down, and when do you think it's going to be up? So I can plan around it.
Exactly. So that's an example of a preemptive strategy. And then I've already talked about some elimination ideas, and that's another chapter where we say that's getting rid of situations where you said it doesn't work. Where is it? How come you haven't? I don't understand. All those types of things where they're species of complaint, really, right? And sometimes to get to the root cause of those and fix those in any kind of business is actually quite hard work. We've got to go, so why are some of our deliveries not getting there in time? Why are some of our products failing when we thought we would design the perfect product? You know, why do customers not understand this aspect of their account? You know, so there's quite a lot of, but if we can get to those root causes and fix them, again, we just wipe out bits of work, right? Then we talked about digitized strategies, and we said, it's got to be, if it is more convenient for the customer and makes their life easier, we will adopt those things. And yes, we have to educate sometimes. Sometimes we do have to walk the line in the branch to make sure people realize what's available to them, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes we do have to use even our frontline staff to say, did you realize you could have done that online, you know? Or have you actually used the app, or have you seen the new feature we just rolled out that you didn't know was there, right? So we sometimes have to do some of the education as well. Otherwise, how would customers know?
Right. And I can see the other side of that, yeah. too. But after about the third or fourth time going down the line, which is what I witnessed one time, it's like, I think you guys should be starting to get the point here.
Oh, exactly.
And then going to your point is, well, if you're not getting people to use the ATM to make withdrawals, why is that? Is it because it only makes available $20 bills and $50 bills? What if we added $1 bills, $2 bills, $5 bills, $10 bills? You think we might get $100 bills? You think we might be able to get more withdrawals that way? Bet your ass you would. What if we were to educate people that, yeah, that handwritten check is scannable. We have a 97% accuracy rate. So try it. See if it works. And and between those two things, you probably get a lot of people out of that line. So in one case, we're looking at fixing the technology. In the other, we're looking at countering a perception and creating a new perception.
Yeah. And an example of that, albeit quite an old one now, is that the New York Motor Vehicle District used to ran a series of almost ad campaigns saying, skip the trip. You know, skip the trip to the office, as in we'll show you how to do some of these things online now, right?
Yeah.
So I think that was a very smart strategy. It's like you have to educate, you have to show customers how it is things are now possible, but they have to work well as well, Adam. And in the chapter we write about digital strategies, we do talk about, you know, there's often three different problems. One is digital services are provided, but they're not working that well. So we need to understand, you know, where they're creating new issues for the customers, or customers don't understand them, or they're not intuitive, or they're badly designed, right? So we need to fix those things up. The second related digital strategy is where we're actually missing some services that customers want. So that could be your example of, we want dollar bills, we want $100 bills, and we haven't provided that capability.
Yeah.
And the third is where customers are just not aware and need to be educated on what is now possible and how to use it. So we're getting more from what we've already created as a digital service and trying to, but doing it in a smart way. We don't say like, there's nothing we hate more than on every call someone says, oh, have I told you about our internet service? It's like, if you told me about that on the last call and the one before that and the one before that, I'm already annoyed. Yeah. So we've got to be smarter at doing that. So it's like maybe there should be a flag in the CRMs of these businesses saying education has already been done.
Right.
Don't do it again. Don't waste their time. Don't waste your time. But you know the reasons that happens is because these companies bake it into their process and bake it into their quality monitoring systems and said, you have to educate the customer on every call. And so you get this really ineffective way of doing that. Oh, did you know we have an internet service that does, you know, it's like, I heard it 15 times before.
Uh-huh.
And it gets annoying, doesn't it? If you do it
well, what it also leads to, and I've been on the receiving end of this a couple times, is you're calling in because you're having a problem. This is the fourth time you've called. I'll give you the example. A previous client of mine owned a bunch of internet domains, and he was donating one of those domains to a local charitable organization. My client used one registrar. We'll call them Registrar A. Mm-hmm. And the recipient organization used Registrar B. So Registrar A, you know, I was trying to contact Registrar A on behalf of my client to get the settings changed so that the domain could be transferred with entering the auth codes. Anybody knows about transferring domains for registrars knows what I'm talking about. And they kept giving me all kinds of grief. It seemed like no matter what, there was always more information they needed. There was something else. It's like I'm on my fourth or fifth call about that. And it was to the point where they were expecting my client to interrupt his multi-million dollar business to personally get on a phone call and say his mother's maiden name when I had already given him his mother's maiden name. For Christ's sake, he gave me a social security number that indicates a level of trust in me to handle this business, reflected by the large amount of money he was paying for the service. So Registrar A, having, I'm now at four phone calls to them over the course of the week. They say, well, okay, so you're trying to give this domain to this organization that uses Registrar B. Why don't they just come become our customers at Registrar A? And I said, I'm calling to complain about your service, not ask for more of it on behalf of somebody I've never met.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Now, as I had to listen to another sales pitch, and finally, two calls later, my client got on the line. He came in and conferenced in, and as soon as they were where he's connected, he said his mother's maiden name and then hung up.
Yeah. Oh, it's crazy. I mean, what you're describing there, Adam, is organizations sometimes just don't recognize you have to earn the right to have certain other conversations.
Yeah. This goes back to reason it occurred to me is I heard you say that organizations sometimes required to go through education. Well, trying to upsell your service is a form of education. So the people on the front lines, like for all I know, that representative at Registrar A might be saying, this is total bullshit. There's no reason. The guy gave us his client's mother's maiden name. We should just release the damn thing. But nope, I got to try and get him to get this other company to become our client. And then I got to educate him on security procedures. He's already been through it 5 times, but they're listening and they'll fire me if I don't do it.
Yeah. So these standard identity processes are just becoming more and more problematic for customers. And unfortunately, you got the other side of it. I'm not defending these businesses because we sometimes think it's ludicrous as well. All the fraud and the organized crime that's trying to penetrate these systems. And so unfortunately it's back to this idea of we're now having to put all customers through the exception treatment because of the odd fraudster or the odd bad guy somewhere in the system, right? So we're having to say, even though we really do know it's you, you've still got to answer these 4 additional questions because of the risk that, occasionally someone steals your mobile phone or steals this and gets access to your identity. And that's what's causing this ugly problem that we're having to use more and more mechanisms to identify customers before we can even talk to them about stuff. I mean, let me tell one ludicrous story on that regard, which is...
Oh, please do. I know you've wanted to tell a story for almost entire conversation. Lay it on me.
I live in Australia, but I come from the UK originally, and I've still got a bank over in Britain. And I was trying to deal with them, had to do some transactions with them, and so I rang up to do stuff, and I kept failing ID, right? And they'd asked me my date of birth and address, and I knew all those things, and I gave them the answers, and I still failed. And the security systems are so tight that they can't literally these questions are popped up one at a time to the agent you're dealing with. And they can't even see the account until you answer those questions correctly. Okay. So I failed. I couldn't get access to the account. So I go about 6 months later, I'm over in Britain. So, loaded down with passports and identity documents to go into my bank branch to prove that I really am who I said I am. And go up to the counter. They said, okay, good. You've got access to your account, Mr. Jaffe. Great. And I said, by the way, what age do you have? What date of birth do you have on your file for me? And the teller said, oh, we've got 1st of January 1900. I said, do I look 118 years old or whatever?
No. You don't look 119 years old.
Exactly. And I think you and I would know that means that date has been reset to zero.
Right.
And that's 1st of January 1900 is the...
That's a default date when they're transferring a ton of data from one system to the next.
Exactly right.
And it's not, letting them upload the CSV unless that blank is filled in for every record. Go ahead.
So I said, did you do any kind of data migration recently? And they said, oh, yeah, we've moved systems from this to this. And I said, did some of the data births get wiped out? And she said, yeah. I said, but you're still using them as identity checks, even though they've been wiped? So this is how ludicrous it becomes. So I could see the problem straight away. But then why wouldn't you have another bit of logic that just says, and if it's 1st of January 1900, don't use this as an identity question anymore.
Right.
So it's just lazy thinking and lazy programming.
I knew as soon as you told the story, because that's a standard protocol with developers when it comes to transferring customer records where the date of birth is missing on some of them, but it will not accept the CSV unless that's filled in for every customer. For the ones where it's blank, they put 1/1/1900 because it's supposed to be captain obvious that that's a placeholder.
Yeah. Exactly. But so it's just a great story of how processes can get corrupted, and you need to think these things through. And then you need to give me a workaround if, like, if that's what you've done. Anyway, so these are all good lessons, I think, for startup businesses. Because one of the other concepts we talk about in the book, Adam, that I think your audience will find interesting is we talk about another reason people need to do this strategy is the best companies, many of them we call innovators in the book, are tend to be the newer businesses that are kind of set up to be frictionless. Uh-huh. And they're being successful because they've taken away some frictions in their industry. And while we don't want to sing their praises universally, if we think about an Uber and how different an Uber transport experience is now compared to the old taxi experience, where I used to have to ring up and wait in a call center to get a booking, and I didn't know when the cab was going to come, and I had to fiddle around with my credit card before I left the cab and fill out paperwork and sign things. And I've had card fraud where rogue taxi drivers have used my card, to try and fake transactions, all kinds of things, right? Compare that to the Uber experience of, you make a booking, you can track the driver on their way to your house or wherever you're being picked up. You can talk to the driver directly. You can rate the driver. They rate, it's a completely different experience. And so they're an example of an innovator who's disrupted that industry through a better experience. And so if in contrast, the older style businesses, we call them renovators, if they don't start to do some of this stuff, potentially they go under, right? Because the newer businesses are starting with less legacy, with less complexity in their businesses, and can design these experiences from the get-go to be better. I mean, that is why for all their, some people may not like Amazon, but Amazon rate really well in terms of people's rating of their experiences. And they work at it continuously to try and make things better. They really are obsessed with customers, and they try and make it more and more streamlined to make everything work. And a lot of businesses just don't have that philosophy, which we kind of get, and we talk about, well, why don't they? And sometimes it's because, measurements and goals are kind of competing with that. Some companies just get fat and lazy and arrogant and think that, they don't have to work at it anymore because they're the dominant whatever it is in their industry. Anyway, I hope that is useful.
Oh, that's extremely useful here. So we are near the top of the hour here, but there is just one more thing I want to clarify, and this may seem like sort of a left field thing, or maybe it's not. But there's one term in the notes that you gave me before we started this interview, and it's the term whole of business. You may have mentioned this before, but if you are, I'm asking again, if you could be clear on what whole of business means. I think I know, and I think it's a great way to tie all this together.
Thanks, Adam. Yeah. So by whole of business, it's back to this issue that if we're right, that signs of friction are the interactions we're having with businesses that we don't want to have. We're saying to solve that problem, we need to involve multiple parts of the business and potentially the whole business, right? So that the place you look for the problems is the customer-facing parts of the business, be they contact centers, be they branches, be they, chat teams, be they email handling teams, right? But the place you look for the answers is much broader than that. So it might be the inventory management guys. It might be the guys in the warehouse who aren't shipping goods out on time. It might be the service providers who ship the goods for us, some of whom aren't working efficiently. It might be some outsourced provider of other things that isn't working well with us. It might be some of our suppliers who we need to bring into the discussion because they're delivering late or they're shipping us faulty goods and we didn't even recognize it. So at one point, for example, just to give a further illustration of that, Amazon used to have a policy that if something got shipped back to them that was a new product that might be faulty, they would shut down sales of all those products until it was proven not to be faulty. Right? So they would be happy to sacrifice revenue. So think about that. So that problem is rippling now from customer service who've got a return back to product control somewhere and inventory control saying, hang on, don't let any more of those out of the warehouse, back to the manager of the relationship with the supplier who's got to go and have the conversation about is it faulty or not, we've got to test some more. But see how it ripples through the whole of the business.
Oh yeah. Hence that. Yeah. So again, that's all very important. So we're, you know, at the top here, and I do encourage everybody, visit the website frictionlessorg.com. That's www.frictionlessorg.com. And this is where you're going to discover the book, The Frictionless Organization, Deliver Great Customer Experiences with less effort. You've heard from David Jaffe, who's been with us for the past hour, and you'll get to know both him and his co-author, Bill Price. Go pick up your copy. It's something I'm really looking forward to reading myself. And you'll also find there how you can connect with both of the authors on LinkedIn, and also other ways that you can gain if this area of business development is something that is highly of interest to you today. So with that, David Jaffe, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor, believe me, in education.
Oh, thank you, Adam. No, it's been great fun.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.